Pennsylvania. I said, listen, I've traveled every road in Pennsylvania. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere.
Wir müssen klinken die glasses.
Wir müssen klinken das glass. Oh. Mm. Yeah, so here we are. Welcome to Barnstorming.
Yes, welcome to Barnstorming, Jordy.
Taylor, I'm Jordy Comas. I'm one of the co-producer, co-host, co-founder. Back in 2017, we started.
Crazy. Distant times.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Taylor Lightman, and I work in Climate Smart Neighborhood Revitalization.
I've never heard it said that way. That's great.
You know, I've been thinking about this recently, and I've been racking my brain to describe what I do. And the term Climate Smart Neighborhood Revitalization came to me. And I think that accurately describes what I do. But anyway, I'm speaking
here. Saving the planet for you dumb motherfuckers? That doesn't.
No, I mean, but I think actually, you know, it's like climate change is a huge, you know, it's like a huge breadth of things. You could be a marine biologist and solely work on climate change. You could be a, you know, oceanography, or I just said that. You could be in a, do astronomy or something like that. We'll cut this out.
And no, we won't. The ocean stuff is on your mind because of the UN's historic.
Yeah, that was on my mind. Yeah. You could do a lot of things and be, I can't think of anything right now, actually, other than the oceans.
You could be a refuse collector. You know, you could be, you could own a gas station.
You could work with reptiles.
Yeah.
And climate change.
You're really into the scientists who work with life forms mode right here.
Well,
right.
I went to the Lycoming County dump today and passed reptile land.
Ah.
So that was on my mind.
So refuse collector, like I said, is not crazy.
Yeah. So that's a refuse collector, reptiles.
That's right. For those of you who don't know, and here in Union and Lycoming County, we have a wonderful, everyone should visit reptile land. Route 15 north from Lewisburg, you pass prisons, world-class reptile museums, and a landfill.
Yeah, beautiful.
It's interesting. So
I have to ask, you pronounce it reptile as well. Is that a southern thing, or is that...
Versus what?
Reptile.
What the fuck is a reptile?
That
sounds like what the proctologist does. Give me a reptile exam.
Somebody once told me that it was pronounced reptile, and I said... I don't think so.
I mean, I think English has proven it's big enough for a lot of kinds of pronunciations.
Yeah,
I'm not aware that that's a particularly Southern thing.
reptile.
Yeah.
On this show, it's reptile.
Right. Okay, on this show, it's reptile.
Yeah.
I'm also I'm a community and political organizer, and something we need to continue to add all the time is whatever we say are our own opinions on this and are in no way should be construed as the opinions of any organizations that employ
professional or personal
that we're on the board of.
organizational relationships.
Yeah, exactly.
So
there you have it. We do have a store, and you can support the show on Patreon.
Yes.
And actually, probably not the best time to bring this up, but we do have somebody who asked me if we could have more variety of t-shirts from about 6 months ago, and I said we'd get on that.
Yeah, well, okay, yeah. We'll go to the store now though. barnstormingpa.org/shop.
And I believe on Instagram it works.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
Maybe some other places.
Yeah. But we'll, yeah. It's good.
So I think this is kind of the inaugural podcast of season 5.
I couldn't say what season we're on.
We're gonna say it's season 5.
Okay.
One of my favorite podcasts that's just a humor one called The Bugle. He's like, he'll like take a break and be like, this is episode 12,433. Like, he'll just jump because he doesn't know where it is.
I feel that way a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. So we wanted to just get back in the saddle, talk about the state of the state of the state.
Governor Josh Shapiro will give his budget address to the state of Pennsylvania and the legislature gathered tomorrow, Tuesday. We're doing this Monday night, speculating about what the address will be. So by the time you hear this,
I'll get it out tonight, early tomorrow.
I doubt that.
I will.
Okay.
Now that I've said it, I will.
Okay. It's on the record.
It's on the record. Also,
but yeah. So anyway, it's state of the state of the state, and we do realize that the state of the state is not the budget address, but the state of the state of the state is too good of a title to pass up.
It is too good of a title to pass up. Things I should know. Does our governor, is he required to do a state of the
state of the state?
State of the state, a state of the union. It should be the state of the Commonwealth, of course.
It should be, yeah.
I don't actually know.
I don't know that either. I can't say I've ever watched one either.
But I am interested. I'm planning to watch tomorrow's in part because I feel like as somebody who came into doing more and more advocacy in politics, like my focus has been shifting from like the national stuff to more state and local all along, for the last 5 or 6 years. So I actually, and I also feel like for our podcast and for things you and I do, there's still a big like information gap, right? Like you and I mean, I have this experience, you chime in, but I'll be talking to people and I'll say something that's should be common knowledge. Like, you know, for example, one of the things we'll talk about is the lawsuit that said that Pennsylvania's schools are out of constitutional compliance in terms of education levels. And people who would want to know that and would like know more about national educational news, like don't know that. You know what I'm saying?
I do know that. I mean, I don't know why that is, but I do think it's super interesting. And I have to say, me personally, you don't encounter the news. Like it's not in the New York Times.
Right.
You know, it's you kind of have to, and the local papers usually cover local stuff.
Right.
And it's you sort of have to go out of your way to find it, which is sad, but you know,
you do
that's the case.
But I also, I think I know why. It's so much less is invested. And let me give an example, which is actually a great segue. By the way, we're doing this with no agenda, no notes, totally without a helmet, without safety equipment.
Men with podcasts.
Men with podcasts. I might have said bareback podcasting earlier and watched Taylor
gross.
shudder in horror. But what I was going to say about the news vacuum is recently we had this incredibly dramatic, interesting situation in our state legislature. And I will try to give a very abbreviated version. So
very, very abbreviated.
Very abbreviated.
Yeah. But it's complicated.
It is complicated. And the reason I'm telling this is to talk about how differently this would play out were this to occur at the national level.
But really quickly, the Democrats almost gained control of the House, the Pennsylvania House, but were like 2 votes shy due to some deaths and people moving on and retiring. So we were like 3 votes shy or something like that.
Right.
So we were technically not a majority, but in no way was it not going to be a Democratic majority.
Right. So
tough situation.
Tough situation. Yeah. So picking up on that in, I believe in, we'll say in late December, early January, the whole House came together. And as Taylor said, the Democrats had won 102 seats, but could only bring 100 people to this vote, which was the vote on the rules and the speaker. And that's because of what Taylor said. So in that moment, no one knew it was going to happen. And in some sort of back room, what happened was one Democrat, Mark Rossi, who is friends with some Republicans over, I say friends, I mean, at least allies I know, but they're close over the issue of both of them advocating for sexual for relief and the ability for sexual assault survivors to be able to take action now, because Mark Rossi and the Republican, I can't remember his name, were both themselves survivors. Anyway, it was that relationship, which is kind of the old school parliamentary, you know, thing that people pine for in the good old days, right? Like they have friendships. They threw their support behind Mark Rossi to be like the interim speaker until the special elections happened.
Yeah. Which was very important because if you want to get a constitutional amendment passed in Pennsylvania, you have to pass things in two consecutive sessions.
Right.
And then it goes to a vote, I believe, or something like that.
That's right. Yeah.
And the Republicans had needed just even one session to pass some awful shit like a statewide abortion ban and stuff like that.
Right.
So it was looking very dire, in fact.
Right. So here are the stakes, right? So we have this interim speaker by just a few votes for a short period of time. And what was he going to do? And then also these special elections happened and the Democrats did pick up the 2 seats. So now could have an actual 102 people in the room. But, you know, I know I was asking on Twitter and other places, like, well, what happens? Like, can they call a new vote for the speaker and for the rules? And I think collectively, a lot of us, we watched this play out at the federal level with Kevin McCarthy and his like 15,000, you know, attempts to become the speaker. So we're more attuned to this.
15.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. 15. I was off by several orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying was like Taylor and I are either in the know or we know the people who are in the know about what could or might happen. And there wasn't a lot of information there. If this had been happening at the federal level, there's a whole ecology of people and reporters
there would have been stories about the story, the cultural implications.
Who saw who at a bar, anonymous sources, and none of that.
Yeah, it was really odd.
So
actually, I think I saw one article in Politico that acknowledged that this situation was happening. But other than that, it was very much under the radar.
And I want to take a moment before we get to Shapiro's budget preview, his movie trailer version of the budget. Shapiro's the new governor of Pennsylvania. That Mark Rossi, who I knew nothing about, I think he did some really good things, and I hope that, you know, that history will bear this out. So he was this interim speaker in this like really unique, like he came in with the support of a few Republicans, and something happened where they were like very whiny, and they were like, oh, you said you would deregister as a Democrat and be an independent. And he's like, I just said I would govern as speaker as an independent. So they were mad at him, even though they voted for him. But there's been a lot of pressure to change the rules that the Pennsylvania legislature goes by. And Rossi did a speaking tour of four or five places around Pennsylvania. He went to Wilkes-Barre, Philly, Pittsburgh, I think somewhere in the Northwest also. And I went to one of these and spoke about what needs to change with the rules. And one of the things he wanted, and this gets back to the constitutional amendments, is like that each proposed amendment to the Pennsylvania Constitution gets a straight up or down vote. You don't burden it with like bundling with other things, because what the Republicans had done was to take, because what we need is a constitutional amendment in Pennsylvania that'll allow people like Mark Rossi and the Republican colleague who were sexually abused by Jerry Sandusky or Boy Scout leaders or the Catholic Church, right, when they were children 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, to be able to seek justice now.
Yeah.
And so that amendment needs to pass. And the Republicans bundled it with a bunch of horrible amendments about voter suppression and trying to keep the governor from doing his job. So Mark Rossi wanted amendments to be able to be voted on up, down. And that's just rules. It's not in the Constitution. It's not in the laws. It's this whole part of governing that's so inside baseball, but it's so important. And he fought for it and they got it. So we have better rules. And he stepped aside. You know, Joanna McClinton, I think we should talk about this. So just like 2 weeks ago, last week even, right, they brought all these people in, they voted, Mark Rossi, and I should have set this up, but basically he was like, he said like, I can count votes, and I was not the right person at the right time, but you are, and he gave her the gavel, and Joanna McClinton, who's our first African-American woman Speaker of the House, gaveled the session in.
Cool.
And it's super cool. It's super cool.
Yeah.
So that sets the stage. Any other thoughts on the change in power?
It's a nice change of scene. It's been a long time since the Democrats have had a majority of either the Pennsylvania State House or the State Senate. And something that drives me absolutely crazy.
It's got to go back to pre-2010.
It
100%, because the Republicans.
Yeah, I don't know that off the top of my head.
But I saw, you know, had we done notes, I saw something the other day that had, you know, the blue and the red. But
I mean, I think back as far as like the 1980s, and most of the time, the Pennsylvania House and the Pennsylvania Senate have been held by Republicans.
For sure, one or the other. In terms of both, like them having both chambers has been.
Yeah, it's been pretty.
So the last 10 to 12 years, both. But before that, it was more flipping. Sometimes one, sometimes the other. Like I do know that that's accurate. But I also, just because I think this is smart, I wanted to say this. We have a one vote majority in the Pennsylvania House. That means we're one mini mansion or one Joe Manchin or one Kristen Sinema's cinema. Oh, I had another one.
A mini mansion, isn't that just a normal house?
Yeah. Oh, I had a funny one for Kristen Sinema. Kriniman. That's a criminal. We're one Joe Manchin or one Kristen Sinema away. And there was one Democratic member of this caucus. And this goes back to the news vacuum. There's 102 Democratic legislatures just in the Pennsylvania House. I can't follow that many. I don't know.
No, I don't. I don't.
You know,
I don't know that many specifics.
I don't either. But
it's a lot. It's a lot.
It is a lot. Yeah. You know, they did hang together to get McClinton in. It would have only taken one or two to bolt, and like, you know, one of these things like an Andrew Yang or like, you know, oh, I wish we just had a more moderate blah, blah, blah. And given, you know, these are state legislatures, like as Brian Sims, who used to be a state legislator, a friend of the podcast, once said, you know, the only thing it takes to become a Pennsylvania legislature is like residents in Pennsylvania being 18 and a pulse. And his point was, it's not necessarily a meritocracy. So it would only take one of them with an ego and a not very good understanding of politics, is my point, to really scuttle a lot of good possibilities.
Yeah. So we both read an article in the PennCap Star, Pennsylvania Capital Star.
Hey, would love for them to be a sponsor. Great news outlet.
Yeah, absolutely. Love the PennCap Star. On.
By the way, this is my annotated version. Isn't that cool? Like, this is a tool online.
Good. Yeah. On the budget address that he's going to give tomorrow, and we both read it, and
what stood out?
Well, so I would say that in this article, the thing that stood out to me the most is the reporting that I've seen on the House, what the Pennsylvania House Democrats are doing, mm-hmm. and what they step forward is like three different ultra-progressive versions of how to legalize marijuana and legalized euthanasia bill, you know,
to be clear,
end of life.
Those are not related.
They're not related, but they're like two separate bills. And then Josh Shapiro's thing was very focused on education and the economy. So I actually thought that his priorities were refreshing. I don't know about the specifics of what he's going to do, but
I got to call you out. He's talking about making Pennsylvania more competitive, funding education, and keeping the deficit in line. That's like not a new set of Democratic priorities. What's refreshing about that?
The focus on the economy and on education, I think, is like
every Democrat runs on that.
Yeah, but it's,
you got to do more to convince me that that's refreshing.
Well, what was refreshing to me about it was that it seemed like the Pennsylvania House Democrats were trailing, going after really niche social issues that are good, but like are not like bread and butter, you know, really build capacity for the state of Pennsylvania in like a great way that like brings business. And
so the frame of reference for refreshing is compared to the rest of the Democratic caucus in the Pennsylvania House,
who seemed like they were just off in the middle of nowhere, doing some kind of niche
policies. I'm glad we didn't work this out because I think you're crazy.
What are you talking about?
I think talking in a real way about marijuana legalization is of huge interest to a vast swath of Pennsylvanians, and it cuts across a lot of traditional left-right lines. So I think it's very smart policy and very smart politics. And the only reason a lot of Democrats don't, and Shapiro, who comes from a background as the attorney general, is he's still beholden to this ridiculous war on crime bullshit. Now, I'm not talking about the specifics
I'm not saying that it's not a good policy. I'm just saying that I don't like, I don't know. I think if you polled the majority of Pennsylvanians, that wouldn't be more than 20% of them's number one issue.
Okay. That's fair.
Or 10%, honestly.
That's fair. But I would also say that a poll that asks people what is the issue in your mind is basically asking them what have they heard talked about the most in the media. I think a far more interesting poll is to give people six.
I don't think that's being fair to the average person. I mean, it's not, sure it is. You know, like everybody's worried about train derailments right now because of, mm-hmm. you know, a tragic train derailment. But, you know, train derailments happen all the time. Right. That doesn't mean
your sentence really went off the rails there.
I know. So there's a little bit of that, but I do think that on the whole, people know that, like, you know, kitchen table economics is like of utmost importance for a lot of people. Like,
first of all,
paying the bills, you know,
$7
a dozen.
You know, when people say the economy matters, that's also like saying, you know, the ecosphere matters for life on Earth. I mean, the economy touches everything, and I'm not throwing shade at Pennsylvanians. I'm just saying, I think it's far more interesting, and we're on a side note, but that's fine, to give people six or seven real policy areas and say, you know, what would you rank these in importance? Because when we just ask people what matters to you, you tend to get people being
ignore the survey design.
That's what's important here, because we're talking about whether marijuana legalization matters. And I'm saying, I think that there's a kind of, you know, there's a bit of hegemony. There's a bit of like setting the table between the media and a lot of Democrats to not make that front and center. Yeah, and if you said to a lot of Pennsylvanians, marijuana legalization, fair funding for K-12 schools, reforming the tax code so that rich pay more of their fair share, and ensuring like better, affordable health care insurance for all Pennsylvanians, and you ask them to rank those, I'll bet legalization of marijuana is in the number one or two, I'm guessing, for 30% of Pennsylvanians.
Okay. I mean, you talk with more people these days than I do. I don't know if that's true. It is an important issue for a lot of people, but I don't think that, like, it was just kind of frustrating for me to see, like, that be the first thing I see that the Pennsylvania State House.
Did you read the Daily Item article today? Is that part of?
I did, yeah.
So, I'm really, like, being an asshole to you, so you push back, but, like, I don't know.
I saw the euthanasia thing first, actually.
Okay, so we're referring to our local paper, the Daily Item. Which, by the way, I feel like is getting better over time. I don't know if that's...
Well, Eric Chicatano's down there in Harrisburg covering the beat, and I think he's doing a good job.
But, like, it's not like we... Like, the governor got to say, this is my agenda, and then we saw an article that said, Like, I haven't seen the caucus's list of priorities.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's a bit apples and oranges, what you're saying.
Yeah, a little bit, but I mean...
Like,
but
if we had done our homework...
Those articles don't get written on their own. Like these are... Yeah. I imagine that somebody put out a press release saying, this is my bill, this is a Democratic priority.
But they're also in that atmosphere, like Vincent Hughes, who I think was one of them. You know, they know the governor's going to, you know, this is an agenda-setting process, which I think is fascinating. They know he's going to talk about these things. So they're in this moment of trying to expand the Overton window, which is basically, for people who don't know, this idea of like within political stuff, what's allowed, quote unquote, what gets talked about.
But
they're trying to push the Overton window open more.
But wouldn't you rather the Pennsylvania House caucus have, a set of industrial policies or...
I'm so glad you said that because I have some thoughts on that, but keep going.
Yeah, like I don't love the substance of what Governor Shapiro was proposing on the economy and education. Wouldn't you have rather seen, opened up the Daily Article, Daily Item this morning and seen an article about House Democrats, you know, in a dig to Josh Shapiro, that this is going to be so loud for this.
Taylor's referencing the loudness of my keyboard, not realizing what a super sweet,
it's very
quiet keyboard I have.
I would have rather seen like an article about the education system or something like that, you know, mm-hmm. That's my version of what I would want to see in a Democratic Party, you know, a robust conversation about how do we grow our economy, how do we better educate our kids, how do we grow more trees and sequester carbon, and have better policy.
I will raise your critique of what the Democratic caucus is doing and throw a fair amount of shade at you by saying we should really do a podcast after his agenda. After his speech tomorrow, where we look at what the state Democratic caucus, like, for example, Joanna McClinton's speech, she laid out what their agenda is. And I think that's a much fairer comparison than what individual legislators are pushing for, because they're all, and you know this game, they're all trying to differentiate themselves for their own, and I'm not being critical, for their own reasons. And the fact that Shapiro, and I'm inferring here a lot, and I might be totally wrong, but that he doesn't want to talk about marijuana legalization or he's not making it central, to me, reflects...
Well, we don't know that he's not making it central. We just know that he's focusing on education and the economy.
Right. But to me, it's how many more people are going to get pulled into the prison-to-pipeline industry with, like, yet another 6 months or 9 months or 12 months of these ridiculous policies and all that institutional weight? And marijuana legalization is good economics, and it's racial justice, and we need to do it right. And I'm going to say this real quick.
My argument is not that those are bad things. Like, I very much think we need to legalize marijuana, and I'm very much supportive of it being sold in union state stores, like liquor is. Like, I think that's a great idea.
I don't know how I feel about that, but
really,
I just don't know.
So you're anti-union?
Yes, I am. I have some thoughts about the police unions, and I feel like we never talk about police. You know, I actually was at a thing.
You're dodging, Jordy. You're dodging.
I like that I've pushed you into like more feisty, Taylor. This is more fun.
Yeah.
I am pro-union in theory in general. I'm pro-union in general. And I'm pro-specific union. And I feel like we need to be able to be more critical of specific unions sometimes.
Listen, at my local UFCW state-run liquor store, they have wine tastings every Friday and Saturday with a terrific selection. And wonderful, knowledgeable people that will take the time to explain different wines. You're not going to get that in New Jersey.
I've never met a UFCW unionized liquor store employee who knew anything about the product they're selling.
Well, you need to go and see the Lewisburg liquor store because it's fine wine, which is great.
Right? But I will also say that I kind of like our system. I'm not sure that I would favor a move to like a totally privatized system. Now we're on this, but just because the prices are lower and like I do my own research and I go and get what I want. So that's like a shift in model. And so some people move into our state from other places and they miss the like cool wine shop on the corner. And if this store is recreating that, that's great. But let me just say this and then let's move on. Like because I'm controlling the agenda here, I'm the hegemon.
Okay.
if my choice was marijuana legalization, like in whatever way they're imagining it, that's private corporations or through the state liquor store. I would like, if those are my two choices, I would 100% go with the state liquor store because our history of legalizing, gambling and fracking and other industries is so fraught with like corruption and not doing the right thing.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we probably both agree that like any marijuana legalization that was really about doing it the right way would include all kinds of opportunities and incentives for formerly incarcerated people to get in on that and to not allow the biggest wallets and the most likely oligopolists. I love fucking saying oligopolists. I don't know.
Oligopolists.
Yeah.
Isn't that a game? It didn't catch on as much as the other versions.
Yeah. Wait, there's three winners in oligopoly? I like Monopoly, but there's only one fucking winner.
Just not as catchy of a game.
No. You do know about the history of Monopoly, the board game, right? Have I told you this?
I actually feel like I was listening. It was a quiz in a podcast that I was listening to. So it was like...
Well, I don't know about that. I know from my...
What is the
woman who invented it to teach people about how awful monopolistic rents are in cities and landlords. Mm-hmm. And it was meant to be like an educational game.
They snatched the game from her.
They did, and they underpaid her. So it was like, it's just like the most perfect encapsulation of what's shitty about our economic system.
Yeah. Anyway, so Governor Shapiro's education plan.
That was an amazingly terse. Like, what a segue.
Yeah. So
it's like a polar bear plunge.
Yeah, exactly. So what I read is that like, and my understanding is he wants to throw money at our education system to correct the funding.
Can you say a little bit about the lawsuit just to set the table for folks?
So there was a lawsuit against the Pennsylvania education system. Constitutionally, Pennsylvanians are entitled to a robust public education.
Right. And to be clear, I don't know the exact constitutional language.
I don't know either. And it definitely isn't robust education.
No, but you're right about the yeah. But I think it also has something about equitable or fair and
yeah. We're a commonwealth.
No.
Yeah. So
well, we should be a commonwealth.
Yeah. And there was a state Supreme Court case that basically said we're not meeting our constitutional requirements to provide a robust education.
Too many kids don't get enough resources for us to say we're meeting our constitutional burden. Does that sound right?
That's right. And I think part of this is because that...
pause while Taylor passes me the bourbon.
Well, we don't have to pause. We can keep talking.
But then part I have to say that we're not being sponsored by Larceny Small Batch Kentucky Bourbon Whiskey. But if you're listening, Larceny...
Not sponsored by Larceny Whiskey.
The number. Oh, you want some more?
Yeah.
Taylor went from 90% tea to 10% bourbon to kind of the inverse now.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead, my
peppermint
friend.
Tea. Yes. So
peppermint bourbon. That is really fucking smart. Is it good?
Yeah, it's good. Okay. It's really good. So this is in part due to a funding method that Pennsylvania has that was partially corrected by Governor Wolf that said, like, I don't know, and I'm going to butcher it. It's like 40% of the money for the schools is
kicked in by the...
You know more than I do anyway,
the,
so...
By the state, and 60% is by the local property taxes. Right. So if you live in a school district with very expensive homes, your school is going to be much better funded than if you live in a school district where this where the homes are much...
Well, and to be fair, what this... Right. And I mean, of the two of us, the one here who has a master's degree that focused on school finance... Was me,
yeah.
Although it was a while ago.
It wasn't
but,
focused on it. You just did your thesis in it.
Yeah, my thesis. Sorry. Yeah, my whole thesis. That's what
that,
I thought
that
I said.
You're not your master's.
Right. Just the thesis of my master's. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, enough
that,
about
that would,
me.
That would be like me saying I have a master's in land tenure.
Yes. is you know, because we rely on local property taxes, wealthier communities will always have a baked-in advantage. The role of the state is to equalize that. And I don't know the exact formula. It's called the fair funding formula that Wolf followed, but it wasn't enough and whatever. Because this lawsuit covers a long period.
It wasn't enough, and it also seemed to me like, you know, we have an opportunity here as we've been gifted an opportunity to say, wow, we need to rethink our school system. And it seems to me like definitely money is a part of that, but I also feel like, can't we figure something else out? Like, can't we do something innovative or change things up? It can't be that the only problem is there's not enough money.
Well,
which may be like I was educated in a great public school system in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. So maybe I'm totally back at, you know, wrong about this, but I don't know. It seems like, is money the only problem?
So drawing on what I know, which is maybe dated, but I have a feeling things haven't changed very much. What I'm going to say is a bit heterodox, but like, let me just say at the outset, 100% we should have fairness. But it's also, if people think fairness is the same level of educational funding, it reminds me of this one, I think it was Bradbury wrote a short story about like a sort of what's, I think it was Bradbury. You know the story where they like go to see a ballet, but the best dancers are wearing ankle weights so they don't dance well, right? Like if you
I don't know that story, but
you know what I'm saying is like I think given the fact that communities have different levels of wealth and this tied to the property tax, to say that like you're gonna forbid certain school districts that have more resources from spending them, that's a losing political proposition. It's hard to enforce. So you know the focus should be what is the minimum should be. Fucking world class, right? And if the other school districts spend even more, fine. But the minimum should be fucking world class. One more thing. And so here's the other thing, though. I completely agree with that. And if you think that tripling the amount of funding going to school districts where there's more poverty and you're going to see a correlation with lower test scores, if you think in 2 years that that's going to change that, it won't. Because a lot of what affects educational outcomes is the education attainment level and the income levels of the families and of the friends of the kid, right?
Yeah.
So
in essence, like it seems to me like we agree. Like it's both a function of more money, but also like what are other things we can be doing? How could we spend money in other ways to?
I guess I would also say I think your outcomes for schools should not be narrowly are the school districts that serve, kids who are statistically likely to perform less well on certain standardized tests. I'm that's a complicated way of saying, like, I'm not really into test comparisons of school districts, right? You should be looking at different kinds of measures.
How are they growing internally?
Yeah. And even things that I used to see that I think were important was like, you can create a model that says,
what's the truancy rate?
For sure. Lots of things that are more qualitative. How many kids finish? How many kids, there's some interesting stuff out there about letting kids start at different ages, right? So like basically kids start first grade when they're cognitively ready. So you stop pushing some kids who maybe aren't ready. Like that's a conversation we're not ready to have because maybe that means some, you might see some race and class kinds of correlates, but if that's better for those kids, like I think that's what I mean by heterodox. Like I'm willing to talk about things that I don't want to perpetuate, obviously racial or class inequities, but if we're really going to like help each kid in the best way, you can't have a system that expects all kids are going to pass through in exactly the same path. But what I want to say real quick is about like how you could measure is like you can make a model now that says, given the economic and other demographic characteristics of this school district, you know, the average test score is going to be X. And when a school district does better than that, then that's progress. So instead of saying like poor schools don't do as well as rich schools, like no fucking shit, Sherlock.
Yeah.
Did
who's
this
overperforming?
Who's overperforming?
Who's underperforming?
I think that that would be one measure.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I've been, so I've been following this a little bit, but there's this organization based out of California called the Green Schoolyards of America. And their whole shtick is we need to green all of our schoolyards, make them edible instead of the old.
To be clear, the plants, not the children.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not, the zombie
American.
Listen, I've been watching The Last of Us and we need some jokes in here. Nobody wants to listen to us geek out on policy for.
Okay. Yeah. Well, why don't we do a Last of Us?
Are you watching it?
I'm watching it. So we'll end with that. Stay tuned, listeners. Or skip forward 15 minutes. So the idea is instead of these old flat, asphalt slabs mm-hmm. that kids fall and scrape their knees on and mm-hmm. stuff like that, let's basically make all of our schoolyards into like functional gardens that mm-hmm. they can have in it. And it's good for them. It's mm-hmm. good. It's, you know, it's very peaceful. It's good for the teachers.
Grow some hemp.
It's No, it's good for the environment because we're sequestering carbon.
Yeah.
Good for biodiversity. You can also, like, I imagine all kinds of practical applications of having diverse plant life in your mm-hmm. school system, in science classes, in cooking classes.
Second graders tending a butterfly garden and then getting to watch butterflies come, like, okay, like, you had me at green schoolyards.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I...
Grow some pawpaw trees.
Pawpaw trees, yeah.
You know why I'm talking about pawpaws, aside from I love to say it. Because it's a fruit that's really good and it doesn't...
It's native to Pennsylvania.
It's native to Pennsylvania and it's not very commercially viable. So no one eats them because you can't like package it and sell it easily. But all these kids eating pawpaws and going home being like, Mom, Dad, Grandpa, whatever, let's grow a pawpaw tree.
You know, and when Eric Adams was running for mayor of New York.
Yeah.
He kept talking about how like... Any meal that is eaten, you know, like whether it's in a New York City, you know, hospital or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, the school or prison, like it should be like an incredibly delicious, healthy, filling meal, like that is like nurtures the body and soul. Like, I don't know why we're not thinking about that. And, you know,
because school districts usually want to pay the least possible amount for many what are considered ancillary things like food. And so they farm it out to large, you know, companies. Yeah.
Well, you know, and like we should live in a state where like every kid gets a free breakfast and lunch, you know, that's extremely healthy, nutritious, no questions asked. And like that's
before
that
you even say free, I think you should say every child eats a nutritious meal that like eats a nutritious educational meal. Just say that, because the only way to do that is if they all are getting the food from the school. Like the free makes it sound like middle and upper class kids are getting, you know, I just think
I'm framing, we need to make all programs universal. And this is like, we create.
So you are a universalist still.
Yeah. All of these liberal things that try and create all these rules, mm-hmm. You know, to make sure that there's no.
If it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander.
Exactly.
If it's good for the bougie, it's good for the proles. Well,
oh my God. Sometimes these things are more work to enforce than
you're right.
Than to actually just have it be everybody.
And it's gets a free lunch. It's also, I feel like it's such a further, I mean, I'm joking about the bougie and the proles, but I completely agree with you about the universalism because I also think it perpetuates this kind of, I'm going to call it kind of neo-puritanical or neo-Calvinist idea of like the virtuous people and the right.
Yeah.
Like
only
the people who are really virtuous get it. It's like, no, screw this. Right. Yeah. Like everybody should have this kind of meal. I mean, you know, as a foodie, I'm all in on this. Like cheap food is a problem. Yeah. We start to break that cycle this way because, you know, these large institutional feeders, let's call them providers of food, hospitals, prisons too. Like I just realized, like, imagine if you also had this in prisons, how many people who are incarcerated could learn like practical food growing skills that then they could come out and bring those to urban gardens or rural, you know, rural farms.
Yeah.
Why are you making that face?
I don't know. Just assumption about who's in prison, I think.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Or they want to move away. I mean, a lot of people, you know, I meet people who are like, I moved to this little town in Pennsylvania from, you know, Newark or New York because I wanted, like, people who are people of color because they wanted, you know, I'm canvassing in Susquehanna County and I talked to the one black person within a 1 square mile radius and they tell me I wanted to move to a quiet, peaceful place.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that this is kind of our broken education system can't be, the solution to this can't be just giving teachers a $2,000 tax cut.
That was in this. I thought that was so stupid, right?
I hated that idea. Yeah.
Like,
I mean, here's, I don't hate giving teachers more money.
Oh, I do.
To be clear.
Listen, we need to build audience. I think teacher, no, I'm kidding.
But that is, and sure, we should do that.
Just to be clear, the proposal is to have an incentive to hire what they call frontline service. They don't say service. Frontline government employees,
yeah.
Police, firefighters, nurses are not always government. Teachers, yeah. I think it's a $2,500 tax credit
when they pay state taxes.
But it was to attract a new one. So I wasn't even sure who the tax credit is for. It was not clear.
Yeah, and
is it for the municipality?
$2,500 is a lot of state taxes too, I have to say.
Well, like also,
here's my complaint about it.
2% or something.
I'm like making up this number. Pennsylvania graduates 10,000 teachers or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, what this tax incentive is basically like, we don't even know quite how it's written, but like, it generally it's incentivizing people to go to one place versus another. And what we need is 15,000 teachers. Like, put that money into expanding the total teacher corps and labor pool. Because these tax incentives, it's a beggar thy neighbor policy, by which I mean you're incentivizing either individuals or school districts to hire teachers who aren't going somewhere else. In fact, the Daily Item, I don't know why this became the Daily Item, shout out, but did a great series about the teacher crisis.
Great. Good for them. You know, I'll tell you what, Eric Schicitano, if you're listening to this, come on the show. We want to have you.
He didn't write that one. That was like it was a PA spotlight. It was like one of those like multiple.
But still, Eric.
Yeah.
Come on the show.
So we'll have to send this to him directly and see if we get a nibble. But but again, I feel like my job in this podcast is to have all the buckets of cold water to throw in the good ideas. Like
that's your job.
Yeah, today.
Okay.
What will make a difference? Like, it's not rocket science to have better education. You need smaller schools with too many big schools, and I know that there's a savings.
I don't know about that.
I know the research is right.
Okay.
Like a high school that has 2,500 students will not educate as well as a high school that's 800 students.
I'm not sure about that. I mean.
Well, you're wrong, but go ahead.
You and I actually, I think this is one of our first disagreements like 6 years ago. And I feel like I backed off. Like I feel like, yeah, it would be good if you had regional schools where you could do specializations in different schools.
I am all about that, but that school should be 800, not 2,500.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know the research, so I'll trust you. Go ahead.
It has to do with building a sense of community and belonging within the school, and that's super important for young people, for all the things you were talking about, to meet all of those goals we have about education, which gets to some of my concern. Like there's a lot about trade schools, and I think that's great, but I feel like this mania about public
STEM.
Yeah, STEM and trade schools, and that like every educational path should be like narrowly a career path. Like, no, we don't want our education system to turn out like just workers. We want it to turn out citizens.
Well-rounded citizens,
well-rounded people.
Yeah.
Like,
and heck, Jordy, I mean, you know, I would have loved to have gotten a class on like HVAC or electrical stuff.
Yeah.
In addition to my world history.
You know,
like I think it cuts both ways, you know.
You know, poetry for HVAC kids and HVAC for poetry kids. I mean, that's for sure. For sure. So
I had the occasion recently to research a lot about HVAC, actually. Oh, yeah. And
you want to do a plug for our future bed bug bomb sponsor?
No, my parents redid their HVAC, and it was one of these things that it was much more of an art than a science, but mm-hmm. I felt like that wasn't right. So I did a lot of research to figure out what the best system is, and it's not universally agreed upon.
So it's a whole of research that, you know, it has to deal with.
Listen,
with vacuums.
Barn throwing PA, this and, old house, new podcast coming to you, coming soon.
Yeah. So anyway, all that's to say, I wasn't kidding. HVAC is extremely interesting and complicated, and I would like to know more.
What I was trying to talk about with school and education reform, though, is like I'm just going for like all of the people I can piss off so we can get like, you know, evidence. Like we have systemically underpaid the teaching profession forever, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like not always, but generally, you know, higher salaries attract more talented people. So we do not have as many good educators as we should because we underpay. And to fix that is expensive, take time, and it means you're going to bring in, like, if, like, what we need to do is, you know, triple the starting salary of new teachers. Well, how are you going to implement that when you have PSEA, you know, when you have labor union contracts? Like, it is a big thorny problem. And, like, I feel like it's something people don't want to talk about. And on top of that, the exit rate of new young teachers is incredibly high. I read a book a long time ago, and it probably hasn't changed a lot, but for every 10 teachers who graduate with the credentials, a certain number exit the field within like 5 years. So from a societal perspective, right, we're investing a lot. And that's part of my concern is like there's incentives in here about getting people to go to education, to get education credentialing, you know, and this is a little bit me picking a bone too, is like, I thought about being a K-12 teacher at different points in my career. And because I wasn't credentialed, it was like, well, you're not qualified. And I was always like, come on. Right. Like, I mean, first of all, I've been an educator at many levels, like right now in my life, I have huge amounts of education. And of course, being well-educated doesn't mean that you per se are going to be a good teacher, but you could easily create a like 3 or 5 month, like intensive.
Here's a
practicum.
Pedagogy course. Or something.
And a practicum, make it like while you're in the classroom, that kind of thing. And we could open up teaching to more people. I'll bet there are a lot of people. This actually gets to another piece that I don't love about Shapiro's budget address. I think the sentence is like, we need to build for the industries of the future. And Biden was doing this too. And generally, I think industries, people think of making things, right? Like I realize maybe he meant sectors of the economy. But when we hear industry, I think the average person thinks, right, of the economy that makes things, you know,
factory. Manufacturing, yeah.
And you and I both know that there is no future economy in the United States that will employ anything close to the numbers of people that we used to, right? Like if we're talking about good jobs and economic opportunity for people in Pennsylvania, we have to talk about all of the other sectors where there will be growth. And when you add the emergence of artificial intelligence to this, it becomes even more profound. Like I think this question about what is an economy that creates the level of quality of life and goods and services we all want, like the amount of labor inputs that needs is going to keep going down. And unless we're all willing to be stand-up comedians to each other, right? We need to talk about a 20-hour work week that's a living wage.
Yeah.
Like that would be the bold vision I'd love to see from Shapiro.
Yeah.
I kind of moved fast. Do you see where I'm going?
I do see where you're going. I think the thing that I was frustrated about with the economy thing.
Mm-hmm. In Shapiro's speech. Yeah.
It's like a lot of it is about innovation, which maybe I'm a bit heterodox on this as well. It's like
we should call this the heterodox podcast.
Yeah. The heterodox state of the state of the state.
Yes.
Yeah.
The state of heterodoxy.
No, it's a Pennsylvania. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. True.
We're not talking about heterodoxy.
Yeah.
At large.
Yeah. I think we should throw in heterodoxy as many times as we can into our sentences for the next 10 minutes.
Okay. I don't think we're going to out-innovate, like, or I don't think we're going to be like, I don't think that prosperity is going to be the result of innovation, per se, in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know that that's true. And
Can I keep going, but I want to offer a friendly amendment.
Go.
I think that innovation, by definition, if it's an innovation, I'm defining innovation this way now, innovation that gets adopted, by definition, probably creates more prosperity, but it will, it's not necessarily going to be an engine for widespread prosperity or greater economic justice.
Yeah.
for some of the reasons we're talking about, right?
Yeah. Like, well, and I don't actually think that America has been a particularly innovative like country. Like, I think we're good.
Come at us, GOP listeners. Come at us. I think we're not number one
in our economy. Like, I think we're good at like taking things in like.
How dare you? Elon Musk is the greatest industrialist since Henry Ford.
Yeah, well, I think we're good at like mass producing things, and like we're very good at like technology.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's true about us. You know, the internet, and like that's pretty much an American invention. The light bulb, electricity. You know, these are things. But I don't know if that's like innovation.
Having studied innovation some as part of my studies or whatever, this is like, it's sort of interesting to watch you flop around here, but keep going.
I'm flopping, yeah.
You know, things like we've made like the light bulb, like that's the most recent innovation.
Is that innovation?
Versus what?
Like technological creation. Like, I feel like innovation is a little bit different.
Well,
like you're like taking this and you're like changing it.
I mean, I think invention versus innovation, I mean, a lot of ink has been spilled about that. And it is a somewhat interesting topic of discussion, but I think less than sometimes people think it is. Like the light bulb, of course, many people were working on various forms of electricity-based illumination.
What I was really trying to say before this rabbit hole that I'm talking about things that I don't know enough about.
I'm enjoying watching the rabbit hole.
But
I might even throw you a line.
Okay, great. The thing that I did like was Governor Shapiro proposed like a 50% increase in the Keystone Communities program, which is like DCD investing in our main streets, like downtown, you know, neighborhood type stuff, building out our main streets.
Let's quote from the article. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. So I thought that was good. And I feel like that is like really, really solid economic development stuff. And right now we fund that program with $37 million through DCED. And that's, I think it was like $60 million with Ed Rendell. Like that program has been cut and cut and cut and cut. And I feel like that kind of programming is good, like economic development on the whole.
So in the article from our favorite, yet to be a sponsor, Pennsylvania Capital Star, although they're also we're not a nonprofit. They're a nonprofit, so I don't know why we're trying to get money from them. Earlier this month, the governor said he'll call for
a
quote.
They probably make more money than us.
Well, I'm sure they did. A significant down payment in innovation and economic development, proposing a 50% increase for the, quote, manufacturing PA innovation program, which connects state universities with businesses, and a 25% increase in funding for computer science and STEM education through the PA Smart program. This is the governor now. Pennsylvania is open for business. We're going to be a leader in the industries of the future, and my administration is ready to make that happen. Now, I mean, a Republican could have said the last sentence, you know, is open for business. I mean, I wished he would have said Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania is open for everyone to prosper. And that means businesses and workers and the education system, being better aligned or something like that. And we're going to be a leader in industries of the future. I mean, that right there is so hackneyed and so backwards. Like, the industries of the future are the service sectors of the future. Given that we, you know, the things that are less open to being routinized by either manufacturing and robotics or AI in other fields are the caring fields, nursing, education, those. So I wish he would have at least made a little effort to not just repeat great talking points from the 1930s and the New Deal. And the fact that the whole Democratic policy apparatus in general seems to be stuck in this is frustrating. Like, I think manufacturing can be really cool, but, you know, and on top of that, and I feel like I beat this drum, but when people are like, we need the really good jobs we used to have in mining, in this area, in coal mining or in other areas, I'm like, those were good jobs because they paid well. But like a lot of factories, I mean, they were dangerous. So people got, they still have it. There's still I read recently a thing about how the amounts of lung disease problems for people work in mines, like the regulations that were passed had to do with like large particulate, and they didn't even address small particulate, which as other mine safety things improve, there's more of that, right? So like we have a whole new wave of
finer pieces of equipment and drills.
Exactly.
Smaller.
And, the amount of coal you can get from the ground with per worker is, you know, this is an innovation thing, is incredibly more per worker. So, and then in factories, like why would we spend a lot training people the right way in HVAC and all that and to be creative problem solvers if the jobs we hope they get is sitting at an assembly line doing rote work? So I'm, you know. I just feel like this is...
What would you have liked to see Governor Shapiro's...
Yeah, Pennsylvania.
Economic...
Pennsylvania is a Commonwealth...
Not his speech, but what actions.
Oh, policy?
The policy, yeah.
I would love to see, going back to what you were saying, I mean, I'm going to piggyback on some of what you said, okay. Like
I like that.
Yeah, a program, that, I mean, something along the lines of the Green Schoolyard, something that links food... food purchasing and preparation, where we already spend tax dollars, in ways that support rural economies.
Grow our agricultural.
A second, even in here, this 25% increase in funding, connecting state universities with businesses. I mean, what does that mean? We're basically opening up state universities to be the training programs for private industry. How about some tax incentives for them? Instead of giving money to state schools to get them to guess what business needs, get businesses to invest more in their own workers and create the incentives for them to do that.
You could even do a Biden-esque, you know, if you get this money, you have to provide on-site training or something.
Yeah, like absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And in Biden's case, it's on-site.
And by the way, the last governor gutted a lot of our state schools. So now we're turning around and saying, do more. I would love to see them say, let's invest money in basic, let's invest money in like I think exploring ways to use existing information and transit infrastructures so that small scale customized manufacturing and other value added things like in farming and in services, right? So basically our small towns and medium sized cities are places where people can have like jobs where they can get ahead. But also let's just come back to the fucking minimum wage, right? Like where is that? The most effective thing you can do to help the purchasing power of working class people is to raise the minimum wage.
Yeah. To what?
I mean, I think it should be $15 an hour, and I think it should be pegged to something that would be really radical is peg it to a cost of living increase. Because
indexed to
inflation. Yeah, and this is going to be ugly, indexed to inflation. This is going to be ugly, but like I don't feel like the left has a very good answer about the inflation, about the nexus of inflation and wage justice. So like post-pandemic, we had a tight labor market. Wages were going up, and immediately – the Fed and a lot of economic serious people are like, well, we gotta crash the economy and cause a recession, or else, you know, wages are going to go up, which is going to drive inflation. So they're so worried about inflation, which would just be passed on to other, you know, the idea is like, well, people are making more, but they're going to end up paying more. And what we ended up with was,
I think it is true that like inflation is a tax on lower income people, especially.
Well, especially when their wages are stuck.
Yeah.
I don't have a great answer for this, but I just want to point out the conundrum that, like, I think you and I, you know, I believe that everybody who works and works, you know.
I mean, I have to say, like. Nominal wage growth has been really terrific over the past 5 years. And I mean, I don't think that that's.
But generally.
But it hasn't been a policy, but nominal wage growth has grown even when you factor in inflation. And so, like, I don't know.
But so here's how I understand it, right? Yeah. Like inflation bad, like high inflation bad, I should say. Like, you know, negative inflation is bad too.
Yeah.
So they want this band of 2% inflation.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that wages for the minimum wages should be growing faster than that so those people can catch up. And generally, I feel like the economic sector is like, well, they can buy more goods because of globalization and other things. So it doesn't matter. And I'm like, that's bullshit, because the purchasing power when you're at the lower end when you're working poor, even if your purchasing power for food because of cheap food or for TVs is higher or for other goods, the things that people care about the most and need is health, housing, education, and transit.
And good cheese.
And good cheese. So sure, they can buy more Gouda at their local grocery store, but those other things have been growing faster than inflation. So they're never going to catch up. And I don't hear the answer broadly on the left to that. I mean, generally, it's like, well, there's a kind of neoliberal, which is like, well, those people should go to trade school and increase. Like, so they as individuals may be able to earn more. I'm all about that. But whoever is the lowest paid job, there will always be lowest paid jobs in the economy. And those should be able to have a good life.
No matter what. I mean, I'm not opposed to raising the minimum wage, but I have to say, I feel like, you know, like with the way that the labor crunch has happened, nominal wage growth has grown tremendously. And I feel like...
But then why is poverty so persistent at the same time?
Well, not everybody's in the workforce. And getting more people in the workforce is definitely a priority. And that has to deal with childcare and healthcare. And, you know, I still think something like people, you know, only like 23 or 24% of people with disabilities are in the workforce. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of things we can do to grow the workforce.
To be clear, you're not trying to push people with disabilities into the workforce.
I mean, I think
they should probably have a higher standard of living.
They should make the decision if they want to be in the workforce. But I think a lot of people on disabilities can't access the labor force.
Right.
Because there's all of these inane qualifications.
But going back to my persistent poverty.
Over the pandemic, mm-hmm. the percentage of people with disabilities in the labor force has actually grown because of a lot of the things with remote work and stuff like that. So I think that that's actually very positive. I mean, I think there's lots of ways that we can grow the amount of people that can participate in the economy. And I think that that would reduce poverty. But like, it is true that nominal wage growth has been very good over the past 5 years.
Okay. Based on what I know, what you just said, like no change in minimum wage. I mean, you didn't quite say that. But let's imagine no change in minimum wage.
The minimum wage has not changed in Pennsylvania.
I'm just going with what you're saying.
Yeah.
More people going into the economy would be a downward pressure on wages because it would be more people fighting for the same amount of jobs. So I don't see how that helps reduce poverty. Do you follow what I'm saying?
I do follow what you're saying, but I do think that I don't know. I don't have an answer for you on that.
I don't have a great answer either. And I feel like we wandered into some space where I wish I was more.
I think neither of us are qualified to talk about this. But
I kind of agree with you, but I also feel like that's a problem. Like we need to be able to have a conversation as like, you know, like people who care about this that can keep up with like I'm frustrated that I feel like this doesn't get enough attention. Like the basic conundrum I'm trying to point out is, for the first time in like my lifetime, there's this really tight labor market. Wages are going up, and immediately I feel like the whole policy apparatus acts like that's a problem. And at the same time, I'm saying, given how frozen minimum wage has been for so long.
What did you say? That interest goes up or inflation goes up and people feel like that's a problem?
I know they are. Inflation was starting to go up. And you read any newspaper, you listen to NPR, it's like the Fed is going to raise interest rates to try and cause the economy to slow down because it's overheating. And so they say things
that's a good solution, honestly. I feel it worked, you know, like there, and we haven't crashed the economy. So like what's the problem with raising interest rates to slow inflation?
Because in the way they're talking about it, what they're worried about is wages are going up, and they're like, wages are going up. And I'm like, how the fuck are working people ever going to finish?
Yeah.
How the fuck are working people ever going to catch up from the like Reagan and poverty the Reagan era neoliberal poverty trap that we've created? How are working people or people who earn the minimum or close, how are they ever going to get out of that? How are they ever going to get out of it if every time there's wage growth, the rest of the economic policymakers decide that's a problem?
I don't think that's what they described the problem was, because nominal wage growth has still grown. You know, nominal.
What do you mean by nominal?
It's when you factor in inflation. Wage growth outpaces inflation. I think the problem that they thought of was inflation, which is basically a negative tax on goods and services that people need to buy, and is you know, constitutes.
But they say inflation is going up because wages are going up, and therefore we need to
measure inflation. That's not. They didn't.
I know
say
you
that
can measure it, but
inflation is going up because wages are growing up.
That was most of the recent coverage.
Okay.
Why is inflation up? Because of supply chain crunches and because of a tight labor market.
Or Ukraine. I mean,
a little bit, but it predates that. I mean, that, you know.
Well, I don't understand how you. I mean, inflation is literally, it's probably 2% less if you don't count in fuel or something like that.
Well, that's a whole other thing that drives me crazy is they're like, we want to measure core inflation, but not include fuel, now wages, or food. And I'm like,
yeah, that's stupid.
So they're looking for some sort of mythical, it reminds me of the debate about IQ, this sort of mythical unicorn number that represents this, like, this thing that's like the increase of wages that can't be explained for other things. And so they take out everything that would explain that increase in wages.
But I do.
We should get off of this maybe because and maybe research it. But like, I fundamentally, I just want you to like at least acknowledge and understand what I'm saying.
You can email us info@barnstormingpa.org if you know a lot more about this than I want to get on the podcast.
I think that there's a big problem when
people not knowing what they're talking about
I think I do know what I'm talking about. Like, fundamentally, right, we need people, like everybody who in America, there's persistent poverty and there's economic inequality because people don't earn enough at the lower end of the wage scale. And the solution to that, I was saying, was to raise the minimum wage, as opposed to just saying we need more trade programs, we need ways for those people, because that answer says some of those people will move into higher wage professions. And I'm like, sure, that's great for them, right?
Yeah.
But anybody who's still at the low wage economy needs to be able to earn a decent living.
Well, I don't disagree with that, Jordy.
Yeah.
We're in agreement on that.
Right.
And I feel like I said at the outset, I'm not opposed to raising the minimum wage.
You did. But not a lot's going on. And you even said some things. Daycare support would be a huge piece. Obviously, you know, universal health care would like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Would be massive.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think to end, we're going to do something. Maybe I hope this might be fun. I found the Washington Post. They have a quiz. I thought it'd be fun if we do it.
So okay.
It says a quotable news quiz. One quote, three chances. All right.
Hello. You gave me life. I am Ion. Now my role is to represent you like a mirror.
Oh, we have to go fast.
Ion
is a new AI advisor of Prime Minister Nicolae Ciuca's cabinet in which country? Whose capital is...
Oh, it's Romania.
Okay, I'm glad.
Whose capital is Bucharest? It's Romania.
That was a bad question, I'm going to say. Okay. This government aide says it knows what voters want. It's an AI bot. Oh, that was only one question. Okay, this was not very fun. We might cut this. Basically, I think if we come back every day of the week, we get a new question.
Okay, so we just had to know which country.
Yeah, but let's do this. The point of the question was there was an AI bot who was doing something in government. That's what the question was about.
Okay. Well, they should have had that.
Do you have a hot take on AI?
I don't, honestly. I'm sorry. Do you?
Yeah. But my hot take is, and Kara Swisher said the same thing on another podcast, but I'm like,
look at you listening to the New York Times.
She was actually in Love It or Leave It.
Oh, I listened to that too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you heard her.
Yeah. I haven't, for some reason, I haven't listened to her new podcast since she switched.
Oh,
I liked her old one.
I like what she says, but basically she said something and, you know, trying to pat myself on the back. I've said a similar thing, which is like, oh, a bunch of male journalists, an AI comes out, and the first thing they do is try and get it to fall in love with them. That is so, like,
very on the nose.
Very on the nose and stupid. And but then she also said it was the plot of Her, and she sort of blamed the movie for being boring and stupid. But I actually think Her, the movie with
Joaquin Phoenix. I've never seen it, yeah.
Oh, I think it's really good.
I know that's blasphemy to have never seen Her.
No, it's fine. But generally, I feel like people. And, you know, people are jumping to the conclusion that this is sentience, right? That this is Skynet. It's the Frankenstein monster. You know, we've created a sentient entity that's going to destroy us. And I'm like, the point to AI, as I understand, like what these AIs are doing, it is concerning. But by being so focused on whether or not it's Skynet, that's a Terminator reference, right? It's an artificial sentience. It's going to like develop self-awareness and destroy us is missing the point, right? Like, what are we going to do when legal briefs are written by AIs that are as good as
others? That'll be fantastic.
It could be, but we don't even, her point, and I agree, is like, we don't even know the ways in which it might be a problem. Like, go back to 1996, which I know
we have a lot of good sci-fi books and movies.
Yeah, but sometimes they're really wrong. And most of them are like Her, and they say, we're going to fall in love with that these are going to become sentient. We're so focused. And honestly, it's even now that I think about it, it's like a Genesis story myth. We're God and we recreated something in our image that's going to think for itself. And that may not be in any way what AI does. My hot take.
My hot take is I like using it to create a first draft on things. So that's my hot take.
I did see that Jimmy Kimmel asked it to write a joke, and it wasn't a very good joke.
Well, I think jokes and math are two of the things.
Math?
It's terrible at math.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
In what sense? I mean, surely it's good at calculations. It must be bad at, like, new math. I mean, obviously, computers are calculating machines. If you said to a chat, Waterloo, Lackawanna, Fairview, Bellevue, Sweet Roots, Susquehanna, Lewisburg, Stroudsburg, Gillysburg, Orbisonia, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, Willisburg, Robsonia, Mountaintop, Glen Rock, Flat Rock, Sunbury, St. Mary, Schick, Shanny, Big Shanny, I'm a Danny. I've been everywhere, man. I've crossed the valleys fair, man. I've been the mountain here, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Belfont, Southmont, Westmont, Wommelsdorf, Nordmont, Dormont, Lebanon, Hummelsdorf, Cedar Springs, Bowling Springs, Chess Springs, Centerbridge, Centersport, Leesport, Williamsport, Brackenridge, Lumber City, Central City, Lake City, Clearfield, Westfield, Wentfield, Richfield, big deal. I've been everywhere, man. I've crossed the valleys fair, man. I be the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Glen, Wilpen, Tunnelton, Conestoga, Bakerton, Curry Run, Smoke Run, Sanatoga, Slickville, Smithville, Flicksville, Max Tony, Youngwood, Edgewood, Hopwood, Punks Tony, Whitehall, Blue Ball, Center Hall, North Apollo, Delano, Renovo, Laredo, let's go. I've been everywhere, man. I crossed the valleys fair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Been to Stump Creek, Pence Creek, Pine Creek, Chambersburg, Middle Creek, Blakesley, Falls Creek, Shepherdsburg, Johnstown, Allentown, Shepherdstown, Lords Valley, Daisytown, Doylestown, Downingtown, Cherry Valley, Plain Grove, Mill Grove, Mechanics Grove, Swiss Vale, Ferndale, Carbondale, Monongahela, oh well. I've been everywhere, man. I crossed the valleys fair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.